Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to this week's Failed Critics Podcast. I'm Steve Norman. This week I'm joined by Owen Hughes.
Hello.
Paul Field.
Evening, guys.
And Phil Sharman from the Wiki Shuffle.
Hello, pleasure to be here.
Yeah, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us, Phil.
Oh, I'm excited to dazzle you all with my inept opinions.
Yeah, you're the best third of Wiki Shuffle, I believe. Is that correct?
That's my belief.
Yeah, we definitely, between you and me, I think you've got the better voice, just to sort of...
Smoother. Would you say smoother? Smoother?
And sexier, yeah. I think.
Well, like, thank
something
you.
About it.
It's like the guy who done that late night love radio show, who used to give people advice and play love songs.
Yeah.
Plus, you're not a Eurovision fan. That other guy...
There's one of them whose name I can't remember. There's you and there's Jack, I think. And then there's another one. I don't know his name, so he can't be the favourite. I'd remember.
Chris will be pleased to hear you.
Good. Yeah. Good. Anyway, on to film matters. And before we get into the proper podcast, I had a thought while watching the trailer for Legend, the Tom Hardy film about the Cray twins. So he's playing both Cray twins. Could he technically get two, say, if it was good enough, Oscar or BAFTA nominations, one for playing Reggie and one for playing Ronnie, or could he only get one for the film as a whole?
Good question.
That is a very good question.
Yeah, why wasn't this in the prep, Steve? I mean, we could have...
I literally thought about it about 10 minutes ago.
I did hear the rumour that came out very recently, and you can't libel the dead, can you? So
no, but I wouldn't libel the craze.
No, but
there's still people out there.
Yeah, but there was the rumour that they were incestuous.
Well, I was thinking, much like Steve earlier, that if there's an on-screen bit of jiggy-jiggy and they both get involved, can he count that as a three-way?
Well, I mean, if it is incestuous and he's with himself, I mean, what is that?
Don't know how that's attempting to answer the question that I posed.
I would imagine you can get nominated twice for the same film. I can't see why not. It's two different characters.
But because I've not seen them. I can't remember how the award nominations have written that. So say it was. Does it just get? Is it just say Tom Hardy for Legend, or is it Tom Hardy as so and so? So if it was,
it'll just be his role in that film, won't it?
So he could
name the character.
No, that's what.
But he is playing two different characters.
Because people could quite conceivably say, "Oh, he's really good at doing Ronnie, but Reggie, he's rubbish at." In theory. So,
there's an easy way of answering this problem. How many nominations has Eddie Murphy had?
Yeah, I was just thinking.
Well, hang on, let's go back to Kind Hearts and Coronets. Did where he played?
Alec Guinness.
Yeah, Alec Guinness. Did he get nominated for that?
I will have a look now.
Because what did he do? Seven roles.
But he was playing one character, impersonating other people, wasn't he?
Yeah, but it was still him playing everybody in the film.
Yeah.
But
True. And I guess Peter Sellers could have been nominated for a load for the films where he appeared as more than one person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's been a few. Like,
and Jean-Claude Van Damme, of course. He's done it a few times and I don't think he's won an Oscar for it yet, otherwise he wouldn't be in our corridor of praise, of course.
But we need to get hold of the Academy to get a definitive answer on this.
He didn't win. Alec Guinness, just having a look, didn't win. An Oscar
robbed
for Kind Hearts and Coronets. But he got Best Actor at the National Board of Review in 1950.
There you go.
Yeah. So yes, I guess definitively, yeah, I would. No, it's not definitively, but I can imagine that, yes, you can be nominated twice. Because you can be nominated twice in the same year for different films.
Well, yeah, but that's quite
No, we're
obvious.
Saying you can't be nominated twice for the same film.
In the same category, because you could be an actor-director and get nominated as Best Director and Best Actor, but could you get two nominations for playing the same, for different roles in the same film?
No.
Yeah, because the title of the award's not Best Actor, is it? It's Best Performance by an Actor, so presumably there's two different performances going on there. Yeah, I'm putting my money on potentially you could be nominated twice for the same film.
No.
I don't think it's likely to happen, but I reckon it would be within the rules for that to happen.
Listeners, if you know or care, please send us a postcard with the answer on the back, and we'll go from there.
Can you give them your PO box number, Steve? Just, you know.
If they put in a self-addressed envelope. Anyway, on to the podcast itself, and less nonsense questions from me that confuse everyone and put everyone on the spot. We're on to the quiz, where, Owen, the score is now
2-1 to you.
It's exciting.
Yeah, so if you win, you've got to have a film lined up for me to watch for next week.
Right.
Has that happened?
It will happen by the end of this podcast, I promise you.
Okay, so Paul and Phil, you're going to be on the same team against Steve.
Right, Charmin, so... have you got any smarts?
No.
Oh, we're fucked then, because I've never got a question right.
I tend to just rely on my charm.
It could win. You could win in that case.
Good.
Yeah, as we've discussed, you're the most charming member of Wiki Shuffle. We're very pleased to have you.
When you say charm, are you going to offer Owen a handy if he gives you a point?
Yeah.
Oh, even if I don't give him the point, I think that's on the table. But
I thought it'd be under the table.
But it kind of inspired by this week's news. I've done a train spotting themed quiz. Okay, so in the original film, Danny Boyle's original Trainspotting, there were a number of deleted scenes, and most of which are on YouTube. Okay, I've got some here which are real, and some which I've made up, some quotes from those deleted scenes.
Nice.
Okay, you've got to tell me whether it's real or fake.
I am really looking forward to the accent work here.
No accents. No, in fact, I'll give you a bonus point if you read it back in a convincing accent.
Oh, way to pass the buck.
Yeah. I'm good at that. Steve, do you want to go first?
Go on, Em.
Okay. Is this quote real or is it fake from a deleted scene in Trainspotting? I'll crack if this crack is cack.
That is... That's not real.
No, that's not real.
Can't be real.
Yeah, it's fake. Yeah, of course it's fake. It's a really terrible line and terrible pun, and I was embarrassed about it, so I thought I'd get it out of the way first. But well done, Steve. That's first point to you. So, Phil, Paul, opium doesn't just grow on trees, you know. And remember, you can get a bonus point if you read this back in a convincing accent.
Yeah, well, that's not happening. Would they refer to it as opium?
Yeah, they might do. I could see Sick Boy saying that, you know.
Yeah.
Opium doesn't it grow on trees, eh, pal?
Nice.
Yeah, okay. Was that convincing? What do we think?
Well, yeah, I definitely think it
was. You definitely think, yeah, okay. I'm going to give you a point, for a bonus point, because otherwise this is going to go on all night. But what, do you think it was real or fake?
Yeah, go on. Well, I think we can... Yeah.
It was real. It was Johnny Lee Miller. And he says it in a scene called A Thief.
Oh, so do I get an extra point for the character as well, then?
You do. Well, you've got a point for the... for the accent. But you've got... Yeah. Okay. Steve.
Yo.
Get clean, get dealing. That's where the future lies.
That's false.
You think it's false?
Yeah.
I think it's real.
Yeah, I could...
It is real, yeah. Again, it's Johnny Lee Miller's character, and he says it in a scene that's called Get Clean. So, you miss out on a point on that one, Steve. And you didn't even read it back in a in an accent, so you were now still 2-1 down.
Well, I mean, can it be any accent, or is it you got to be Scottish?
No, no. I want a convincing Scottish accent.
Well, first you just said a convincing accent. I mean, I'm doing a convincing Dorset accent right now, as it is my own accent.
Are you from Dorset?
Yeah. Oh.
Where did you think he was from?
Wales?
Not Cockney.
It's not a very convincing accent, I have to say. I'm not convinced at all.
No, I agree. So,
were you in the Wurzels?
I don't think the Wurzels were from Dorset.
Oh, it's all the same.
I think they're Somerset. All right.
Anyway,
good live act.
The only live act.
Right. Bill, Paul, if I have to eat one more Scotch egg or drink an iron brew,
false.
I'll purposefully OD.
There's no way that's real.
No way.
It's false. Yeah, of course it's false. Slightly xenophobic as well. So, yeah, that's another point. So, Steve, you've got to get this and give me an accent to still be in with a chance for this one.
All right.
Okay.
You see how much I care now, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. I've been known to smoke it, sniff it, swallow it, stick it up my arse, and inject it into my veins.
Oh, I can't remember enough of that to do a proper impression. I'm going to say it's true, though.
Well, you've got to give it a go, I think, the accent. Otherwise, you lose either way.
I'll lose, then.
Yeah, well, what are you saying? Real or fake?
I've said it's real.
Was that Renton?
Ewan McGregor's character. Yeah. In a scene called The Interview. And it was real, yeah, of course.
I've had a pity fuck tonight because you've picked one of my favourite films and my favourite author, so it was like so ridiculously easy.
That is a first for you, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, even on the Danny Dyer podcast where you'd seen every Danny Dyer film in about 6 weeks, you still managed to lose.
Yes.
Yeah.
Never turned down a pity fuck.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah.
It was an offering.
Well, either way, whatever has happened now, it's over. And Steve, you've got to wait until next week at least before you can potentially.
I'm going to be on a beach next week.
You are, that's right. And Phil, I think you're doing a quiz for us next week, aren't you?
I am. I will be doing the quiz next week.
Yeah.
I ought to write something, really, hadn't I? I've got 7 days. It'll be fine.
It'll be fine, yeah. I mean, I didn't do this last minute, of course. yeah. So hopefully the quiz next week will be a bit better. But, yeah, I mean, basically, I made the quiz themed around Trainspotting because the news this week is that it's been suspected for a while, but apparently Danny Boyle is going to do Trainspotting 2 based on the book by... Irvin Welsh, which is called Porno.
Yes, finally. Yeah. This has been just going on forever. You know why it's been delayed for so long? Because Ewan McGregor and Danny Boyle famously fell out over the beach.
They did, yeah. Because he cast DiCaprio, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah.
But it's going to be a real interesting one because the background isn't heroin. The background is pornography, where they make what they call scud films in a pub. And they record them on tape, but now obviously things have moved on, so it'd be the same as recording them and putting them online.
So they're going to set it this far after Trainspotting. I suppose they have to with the actors now, don't they?
I think from what I've read is they are going to kind of bring it kicking and screaming bang up to date. So rather than them filming these pornos upstairs in the pub and putting them on VHS, they'll be going online. But more than anything else, I'm looking forward to seeing a character called Juice Terry Lawson, who I won't get too much away, but he's just hilarious. He's one of the funniest characters in the Trainspotting universe, and to see him on screen, who's going to play him is just beyond me. But yeah, it's going to be really interesting.
So Boyle said he's going to do it. Where did the cast stand on this, though? Are they all on board, or are they...
Well, so he says, yeah. So he says he thinks he's going to get McGregor and Johnny Lee Miller back and Robert Carlyle, who apparently they're all doing stuff in America all the time anyway. I think Johnny Lee Miller's still doing Elementary, which was really good. I really enjoyed Elementary. up to a point. And Robert Carlyle's doing his own show. I think he's got a recurring role in something or other.
Wasn't he in that one that was about, you know, fairy tale characters coming into the real world?
Oh, Grimm.
Something like that. I can't
remember.
Yeah,
that's it, I think.
He was in something like that anyway.
Yes.
None of them are setting the world on fire. Of course they're going to come and do the new Danny Boyle film.
Hmm. But basically the news is sort of coming out now. I guess to give a bit of publicity to Danny Boyle, because he's got another film which is due out soon. Steve Jobs. We were really excited to see another film about Steve Jobs.
Who wants to go and see a film about some shithouse twat who sells mobile phones? I just don't get it.
That's a good description of his career, I suppose, summed up in a sentence.
I've watched every single one of his films, and most of them, bar post Slumdog, he's had a bit of a mare. 127 Hours, Trance, it was a bit iffy, and now this Steve Jobs thing. I think he needs the Trainspotting sequel as much as the cast do.
Hmm. Although I still maintain that opening ceremony for the Olympics was fucking amazing.
Oh, that was, yeah.
Yeah, just film that.
Just do that again.
Dramatise that.
Have any of you read the book Porno?
No.
Crikey.
No.
It's going to be challenging to bring that to the screen. Much like we touched upon the other week, Kill Your Friends, which is going to be equally challenging. But it's great to see some proper, you know, filthy 18 certificate films actually making it onto the screen. So not that they're going to show it here, but there you go.
Yeah. Well, mentioning filthy, the Filth, of course, was one that was supposed to be unfilmable. And that turned out brilliant.
Yeah,
I really loved Filth. I thought James McAvoy was absolutely fantastic in that. He was superb.
And there's a sequel to that as well, in book form, where that character goes off to the States and gets involved in a paedophile ring, and it's all very, very dark. So, again, really challenging to film.
As opposed to all those light-hearted paedophile ring films.
Yes.
Yeah, just to cap it off, I guess. Are we actually fans of Danny Boyle then? I know we've talked about some of his recent films. Do we still sort of think of ourselves as fans of his work, or have we never liked his stuff?
I've liked some of it.
His films of the 90s shaped my existence as a human being, I'm sure of that. Shallow Grave, Trainspotting, Life Less Ordinary, I lived and breathed for as a teenage boy, and nothing he can do can ever undo that for me. And yeah, I agree, some of his newer stuff been a bit off the boil. Oh, there was a pun there that I didn't even mean to make.
Yeah, yeah.
An actual accident. But I loved 127 Hours. 28 Days Later is one of my favourite ever films as well. I think he's fantastic, and I think he tries lots of interesting stuff. So revisiting that Trainspotting world, which I loved so much when I was sort of 16, 17 when it came out, I'm well up for seeing some more of that, although I'm not familiar with the source material at all.
Yeah, just the last word, I think that too much kind of focus on Danny Boyle with this project, and it's Irving Welsh who's the real kind of man behind this, because his stories are awesome, and he's one of our literary talents that, as you said earlier about the films, he defined my growing up. I think he's amazing, and I wish they'd make more of his work into films.
What we've been watching, we take a look at what films we've seen in the last week or so, not necessarily new releases in the cinema. Owen, why don't you kick us off in this section?
Sure. Okay, so what happened quite recently, which was a pleasant surprise, is we were contacted by a PR company who are trying to promote the 35th Cambridge Film Festival, which apparently makes it the third longest running film festival in the UK, which is pretty cool. But they're trying to promote the festivals. They've given us some screeners for films. And, sometimes, not to disparage the people who do send us screeners, we don't always get the best quality films. We get a lot of indie films and low-budget, sort of micro-budget indie British or American horrors. And they're fun, and I like watching them and everything.
We do get a lot of shite as well.
We end up with a lot of shite.
Don't mince your words.
I did go through the list you sent me, and I was being very diplomatic in my reply. Because it was like, ooh, an Afghanistani film about a flower arranging club? Ooh, a refugee. So I was like, these are not going to work for me.
So a lot of them are Eurodramas and the kind of thing that gets rejected from Sundance for being too arty. But some of them sounded quality.
Well, they did. And I was scanning through looking for like if any looked a bit dirty. But even they, you know, there weren't any late night Channel 4 ones on there even.
No, there's no sequel to Blue is the Warmest Colour or anything like that there. So, but one of them that I thought sounded really interesting, one that I was really quite keen to watch, it's called Welcome to Leith. And it's a documentary. It's about a small town called Leith in North Dakota in America. It's got a population of about 24 people. I reckon it had about 24 people until this guy called Craig Cobb moves in and he starts buying up all these vacant properties in the small little town. He buys up all these plots of land. And what is revealed is that he's an infamous white supremacist who plans to buy up all the land in Leith legally. This is legally take over the town. Take over the town's government and establish something called Cobbsville, where he invites white separatists and racists from all around the state, all around the country in America to just move in.
Yeah, but here's the thing, Owen.
Yes.
The trailer promises that, but the film doesn't quite give that story. I actually thought it was about Leith in Edinburgh, where Trainspotting is set, and I was like really excited, and then realised it wasn't. You say about getting all these white supremacists to move in. What actually happens is Keena Dutton moves in, this weedy-looking guy with a Hitler tash, his monster of a wife and four kids, and that's it.
It goes into it a little bit in the documentary about why people haven't been able to move in because the properties aren't quite habitable yet. So, they kind of jump in. The two directors, the two guys who directed this, Michael Beach Nichols and Christopher K. Walker, they sort of jump into the story at a point where it's been made public that this guy, this Craig Cobb, has moved into this town. So he's already there. He's starting to buy up the properties and then he interviews the residents who are trying to take this guy to court to get him kicked out of Leith because they obviously don't want him there. They think that he's a menace, he's a nuisance, he's going to invite all these people, he's going to ruin their little community, so they want to kick him out. So what I thought was really fascinating about the documentary, what really appealed to me was that it doesn't turn it into that freak show that you maybe expect it to with all these prejudiced idiots who move into the town and just act like hooligans, hoodlums, throwing racial abuse at everyone, causing all kinds of chaos.
He was just the most vile, revolting piece of shit, on film. He's probably the worst since that, what's his name? Billy from King of Kong.
Billy Mitchell from King of
Kong. He actually made him look good, but in a seriously nasty way. But yeah. I just didn't feel the scope and the weight of a 90-minute documentary about this guy because the people he had around him were a joke. The neighbours, I almost got the feeling they wanted to be on telly because if they were that terrified, why would they go on a film to put themselves... Quite stack up.
Yeah, I mean, possibly there is some degree of that in there, where... Particularly with one guy whose his name's really escaped me, but he's in it for the fame.
Oh, I know the guy you mean, the older guy with the camera.
The older guy who is very confident about the situation, talks about how he's ex-Navy and he's going to stand up to these guys. He's not scared of anybody. He's just going to stand up to them and make sure...
He was ex-Navy during Pearl Bloody Harbor.
Yeah, so he's just a bit of a eccentric... crazy old fella. But then, I mean, what the documentary I thought did really well is, like I say, it doesn't turn it into this freak show. It gives you a little bit of both sides of the argument. And clearly this Cobb and his friends are, as you say, just utterly despicable. They're horrible people. Their opinions are just
abhorrent,
revolting. But you do literally get to see their side of the story. So it doesn't turn it into a look at these people who are being victimised for their beliefs when they victimise other people for literally just being a different colour to them.
We did have the Daily Mail turn up, and then he goes on Trisha. It was all a bit, I was like, really?
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of tabloidy aspects to some of the way that it's presented. But this is stuff that he was doing. They're just documenting what happened to him.
Yeah, but I just didn't feel the threat that they presented was that significant. The guy was
but that, is, bat that is that part got rid of him. That is part of the question that the documentary is asking as well. Because the court case that comes to fruition eventually is centred on domestic terrorism and the fact that he's terrorising the local community. And they're made to feel threatened by just simply his presence in their little
tent. Night follows day, you knew where that was going.
Yes. But either way, I mean, I thought it was really interesting. Some very, very interesting characters. Some interesting arguments as well. About sort of constitutional rights and whether they're being used or abused, as the case may be. About sort of access to personal information as well. That gets covered a little bit with him publishing their addresses online, of digging, like privately digging into their history. About one couple who were there, their young daughter died. She was murdered years ago. And he sort of drags this up and uses it to bait them.
Same token, this guy then agreed to appear, you know, in a film with his family all on the television. I just thinking, mm-hmm. No, if you were really concerned and you were really fearful, you wouldn't want this being broadcast. So all of his supporters, if he has them, now know who you are, what you look like, and where you live.
Yeah, and
it just didn't add up.
Level of threat to that, though. I thought they got that across quite well, that things have happened to people who he's known and made.
No, they made that really, really tenuous link to that guy who committed a crime in the library. That, again, it just, I think they were clutching.
Well, I think partly because they had already covered part of his story and then he did what he did. I don't know.
I don't think they covered his story. I think they put that in and then covered it afterwards. I think if you deconstruct this, there's not as much there as you think.
Yeah, well, possible, I guess. But I mean, I definitely thought it was fascinating.
No, I'm just playing devil's advocate. It's always good to be documented.
Yeah, no, that's good. Yeah, but you know, they use a lot of home video footage as well from both sides of this sort of feud, which gives you a lot of perspective on how both. You know, sides are being treated by the other. And I'm not saying you should sympathise or empathise with either, you know, them for just having this guy they don't like in their town or this guy who's having his tyres slashed on his car because he's racist and proud about it.
Owen, I think it's going to rain. You want to go and pull all those flags in from out the front side of your house?
Is that showing? Oh, shit. It's blown. My cover is blown. I'm going to have to take the swastikas down and hide all my Nazi memorabilia and everything, though.
If only he was joking.
Mm.
If only. But yeah, I mean, it's called Welcome to Leith, and if you do manage to sort of catch it at the Cambridge Film Festival, if you're in the area, it's on Thursday, the 10th of September, at the Light Cinema, and Saturday, the 12th as well.
And just to clarify, I did actually enjoy it. It was well made. It was interesting. Just maybe not a 90-minute film.
I think it'll turn up on Storyville eventually. It's got that feel to it.
Okay. Paul, what have you seen?
This has been tough trying to find stuff to watch this month. And finally, today I got round to watching a new release on iTunes called Fort Tilden. I did look up who directed it, but I didn't know anything else they'd done. They all sounded like a load of kind of really sort of mumblecore twaddle. It's a film about two girls who want to go to the beach. It's kind of in the vein of, if you like Girls and if you like Broad City, it's somewhere in the middle. So you've got these kind of self-entitled New York ditzy hipster types who, you know, the real proper self-entitled skanks. And it's just their story. They want to go to the beach to meet these boys, and all the kind of micro dramas that happen to them as they try and get from their house to the beach. They want to go on their bikes, and then they get stolen. They walk down the street, and there's somebody's left some rubbish by the side of the road, and they try and buy it from a homeless person because they think it's like bric-a-brac for their apartment. There's a lot of cliches there, but I kind of quite like this stuff. I love Broad City. I really like, do you know Broad City?
Yeah, love it.
Yep. Okay. There you go. I knew you'd know, Charmin. These two fucking idiots never watched.
We did a TV podcast, and we didn't watch half of.
You hadn't watched any of the shows that were
nominated for the Emmys, but yeah, that's the level that you're dealing with here, Paul.
And it kind of goes from the Broad City extreme, where they're talking about this guy, and she's like, "Oh my god, his jizz must be like vinegar and coloured orange, and he'd have to bleach and minge out for a month afterwards." And I'm in fits. To 30-minute monologues in the back of a taxi, which is all very melodramatic, and I was really struggling by the end. So they do meet up with them at the end and meet these other girls, and everyone gets their tits out. If that helps sell it, no?
We're not all a bunch of chauvinistic pigs who only watch films with women in deceived tits, Paul.
Okay. But I'll email you the link for it afterwards, Steve. Yeah, no, I mean, I say, if you like girls and you like Broad City, this is absolutely in your wheelhouse. If you hate all that kind of self-entitled hipster shit, then this will be your worst film of the year. Done.
Done. You are indeed. On to Phil, then, and what have you seen?
Okay, well, last night I rewatched for the first time since it came out, and I saw it in the cinema, The Adjustment Bureau. With Matt Damon and Emily Blunt. Now, I loved this film when it came out. It was one of my favourite films of the year in 2011, and I hadn't seen any of it since, and it just happened to have appeared on Netflix Canada, I believe. And I thought, I'll give that a go and see if it bears up as well as I remember. And it kind of does. It's a very different film from how I remember. What I noticed, and the thing that I'll observe about it the most, is it's kind of a 21st century Big, or vice versa. Those sort of real, full of heart, family-friendly, high-concept, stupid films that just bowl you over in their own cuteness, and takes itself much more seriously than it probably should, but does it with so much conviction that you kind of go along with it. Helped by the fact that Emily Blunt and Matt Damon are actually adorable. They're meet cute at the beginning of the film, where Emily Blunt has smuggled herself into the gents' toilets to use the toilets, and Matt Damon's there giving a speech to himself, and she doesn't want to reveal the fact that she's there, but then has to because she's been there too long, is genuinely completely endearing. And they play it so well. And there's just so much about the film that could be lost up its own arse, and it just doesn't do that because it's sincere in everything that it's trying to achieve. Are you familiar with the film?
Yeah, I loved it. I just want to touch upon something you just said about, you know, kind of something that all the family can sit down and watch. And we had guy James Mulliger on the other week, and he was talking about this and said that they just don't make those films anymore. Everything's compartmentalized. Everyone goes off and watches stuff in their own room. And, you know, it's either young adult fiction, you know, for kids, adult. There's not that kind of, you know, unless it's certainly outside of Pixar anyway, where you can sit down with your kids and watch something.
Yeah.
And this, you absolutely can.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't have any kids, so I don't really care about that. But but it's nice to know that the people with children can enjoy it too.
Thanks, Charmin.
It's, if you're not familiar with the premise, and I don't want to give too much away because itself, when it was released, was very secretive about what the twist was. But it's kind of Matrixy. I'm not going to go any further than that because I think that would give too much away for someone who hasn't seen it. But it's never really about that. It doesn't get itself too quagmired down in those details. It's really about the relationship between Matt Damon and Emily Blunt. And you genuinely feel like these are two characters who would love each other, who you want to get behind and you want to get together. And it's really charming for it. It wasn't as effective as a thriller. It wasn't as tense as I remembered it from the first time I watched it, and it felt a lot shorter and as though it had less to say than the first time I saw it. But I still very much enjoyed it and don't regret giving it another go.
Lovely.
Yeah, I still haven't seen it, but I've only heard good things about it, so I didn't realise it had been added to Netflix recently. I will check it out now, finally.
Okay, so I have watched a couple of things this week. First one was a film that I think Owen and one other from last week were talking about, and I can't remember who it was, but it was These Final Hours, the Australian apocalyptic thriller. So I won't go over it too much because it's been spoken about last week. But yeah, really enjoyed it. Like that kind of apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic kind of film.
Yeah, I think we settled on pre-post-apocalyptic. Before the apocalypse. Yeah.
Stop making up genres, Owen.
Getting incredibly niche with them.
But anyway, yeah, so, you know, really good performances, interesting twist on the usual kind of thing you get in those films, because in most of these kind of films, there is some kind of hope, there is some kind of chance of survival. And this, it's made quite clear from the start that there isn't. It's all over. So it's more about the people, their personal journey, their current situation, of what they've got to reconcile before the inevitable end comes, which is an interesting take on it. I don't know if it quite works towards the end for me, but in general, the film is good. And it's certainly worth watching for anyone who can get their hands on it.
Yeah, it's like Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, but without the rom-com element to it, I think.
Yeah.
And a bit more serious, takes itself a lot more seriously.
A bit grittier.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, some very dark things that go on in it.
Yeah, some sort of, a few kind of, I wouldn't say any scenes are quite troubling, but there's certainly a few dark themes.
Well, yeah, I mean, because it's about the relationship between that guy and a random little girl that he finds who he tries to get back to her dad. But it's the moment where he finds her and what's possibly about to happen to her that is just really dark. And, I don't think I need to say any more about that. But, I'm glad you actually sort of seeked it out and enjoyed it, because it seems to have gone down really well from Fright Fest as well.
I've just seen on its Wikipedia page that there is an American remake being planned, which is completely pointless.
Why do they have to keep
it's in a English language anyway, like,
exactly.
You could possibly understand if it was a foreign language film and people are too lazy or thick to be bothered to read subtitles, so they remake it an American version. The Australian accents are not that hard to understand.
True.
There's not even, you know, there's no...
They could have a Dorset accent.
Yeah, or there's no references to cricket in there, so, you know, that's not going to confuse the Americans. I don't get why it... Yeah, but anyway, certainly a film worth seeking out. Also, I've watched the first couple of episodes of Netflix's latest effort, or whatever you want to call it, which is, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, probably, Narcos, which is the story
Narcos.
Of... Narcos, whatever. The story of infamous drug kingpin Pablo Escobar. And that's been really good, the first couple I've seen.
Is he a narcoleptic? Is that where the name comes from?
I think it comes from narcotics, meaning drugs.
Narcotics, yeah, of course. Yes, yeah. That was a terrible joke. Sorry, moving on.
As long as you realised, that's good, because you can only grow from that point of view. If you can't see it yourself, then there's no hope for you. I've heard nothing but good things about Narcos, but I haven't managed to clear my schedule enough to give it the time and attention it's going to need, I think.
It started well, and I'm going to keep on with it. Hopefully, just from my own football fan point of view, it's going to cover the killing of the, what's his name, the defender from the World Cup 94, which apparently Pablo Escobar was involved in.
Oh, yeah. I'm about halfway through and they haven't got to that yet.
So I don't know if it will be covered at all. But anyway, no, it's really good so far. And yeah, Netflix really doing some good work again.
Yeah, they've done really well with stuff recently. They have got a bit of a scattergun approach at the minute, I think. But I think we have covered this before. They're not really that concerned about individual shows and their particular viewing figures, are they? What they look at is similar to like HBO, I guess, in America. They look at their subscription numbers first and foremost, and then they think about the sort of shows that they want to produce. So
surely they look at the subscription demographics, then the numbers, and then produce the shows.
Well, I guess so. Yeah.
I mean, there's lots of things that come in. Silver Brigade. They don't do old biddy, like where I live in Bexhill, the local cinemas. If you've got something with Thora Heard in, everyone will flock and see it, and that will rack out every screen. Whereas Netflix, yeah, the old biddies don't have it, and they don't make anything for that kind of demographic.
I mean, they did reveal, one of the higher ups did reveal this week that they turned down or refused on Top Gear, saying,
yeah,
so they're not catering for the middle-aged men market there.
Well, they're catering for me. And no, the thing for me is the model works so well that it makes me question the BBC. In theory, the BBC is fantastic and it's wonderful and I want to support it in every way possible. Then I look at what actual content the BBC generates for the licence fee and I compare that to what I get from Netflix and which one is more closely tailored to what I'm looking for. And I do find myself, well, hang on a minute, this model could actually work better. Because there's still no advertising, which is obviously what I hate about commercial television and can't watch it because the adverts make me want to kill. But that they are so responsive and so much more streamlined than the massive hulking behemoth of the BBC, which is spending 95% of the money it spends on things that I will never be interested in.
What do you watch that the BBC make? I think for me it would be Match of the Day, some other sports, Doctor Who, and sometimes EastEnders, maybe, if the girlfriend's around and wants to watch EastEnders.
Yeah, you don't have to lie like that, Steve. We know.
Well,
we know.
Danny dies in it now, and he's great. And, yeah.
I mean, I watch some of the comedies that I think they do occasionally put good comedies on. If another series of The Trip comes out, I'll be watching that straight away. Even stuff like,
Storyville.
Storyville's brilliant. The fact they buy up those documentaries, or the rights to screen those documentaries in the UK, is just fantastic. But I mean, even stuff like the throwaway comedies they make, Would I Lie to You, for example, just off the top of my head, even that's all right to just kill half an hour with, or QI or whatever. Just stuff like that is fine. I'm happy enough with that. But I think it's
Storyville. Sorry, I'm still thinking of what I watch on the BBC.
Just Storyville.
Bake Off.
I think what the point Bill's trying to make is, and I'm putting words in his mouth. But
please do.
It's fine, rather words than something else, I suppose. anyway,
you mean your penis, Steve?
I always mean my penis.
Okay.
But it's all well and good making the shows like Bake Off or EastEnders or QI that are just kind of bankers, but they should be challenging themselves to make better, more interesting stuff that they perhaps don't do enough of.
What they shouldn't be doing is trying to compete with ITV by having fucking competitive dancing and singing shows, which make me want to fucking kill myself.
But they are sort of trying new things. I mean, the fact that they're going to move, is it BBC Three? They're just going to cancel and turn into an online sort of channel only.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still going ahead, or there was a bit of backlash to that? And I don't know why, because I don't watch anything on BBC Three.
Repeats of Family Guy and American Dad. That's probably about it.
Only people complaining were the kinds of people who like to sign petitions online.
That's what I came to the conclusion of as well.
Mind you, BBC Three is directly responsible for the Bad Education movie.
Yeah.
Why was that a sitcom that ever deserved a movie to be made?
I think possibly only because Jack Whitehall's popularity is just constantly increasing.
My children really like that show.
I think there's... look, I've never been one of those people who slagged off stuff like Two Pints of Lager. Because I think there is a certain audience who will love it. I was part of that. When I was about sort of 14 and they were doing all these rude things on Two Pints of Lager, and I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was brilliant. You know, you get a bit older and everyone's tastes change and stuff, and it's no longer a show for me, and I probably stopped watching it when I was about sort of 17, 18. But I still think that those sort of shows, they have an audience and it's fine. You know, Bad Education has its audience. Whatever else they've put on there, I can't think. Little Miss Jocelyn was terrible, but they at least give some of these people the opportunity to make something. Whether that's on BBC Three, on a subscription channel, or whether it's just something that you can only get online, I think it's quite innovative. And they have got to move with the times, the BBC, because this sort of choose what you want to watch when you want to watch it culture will almost be the end of traditional TV formatting. So it's a possible sort of dipping their toe in the ocean to see what happens with it. But I think they've got to do something. Or they're going to lose the license fee stuff and get left behind. Especially when they are just churning out stuff that's very underwhelming.
Yeah, and if it's whether or not the model works, because all the programmes that we're describing here, commercial television makes two, and in a lot of cases makes better.
Well, Sky is just they're constantly making new stuff now.
Yeah,
all the time.
And more interesting and more envelope pushing stuff as well. Series like Fortitude earlier this year. You know, BBC's not tried anything as big scale and ambitious as that for as long as I can remember. Mainly out of fear of having to justify itself.
Wasn't Fortitude like the most expensive British TV show ever made or something?
I would imagine so.
And it was...
It wasn't just the BBC, though, because I saw it before it hit Sky and it was in the States.
Yes, it was a co-production, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But, you know, even stuff... They don't make... Probably since Luther, I don't think they've made any sort of drama, crime, thriller things that I've been interested in. Yeah. It's literally just sort of comedies and maybe Storyville now that I tune in for.
Yeah.
Maybe that is a lie. Some of the other documentaries they do produce occasionally are quite interesting. The Bletchley Park one that was on this week was quite interesting. But they don't seem to do too many of them.
God, you know how sad? I once put a Freedom of Information Act into the BBC to get... Because they keep crying on about how many people have watched their programmes on iPlayer and what the top 10 are, what the top 20 are. So I asked them what the bottom 10 and the bottom 20 were, and they refused to tell me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I had this feeling, I bet you there's something on iPlayer that nobody's ever watched. There's going to be a Welsh language documentary about bell ringing, and nobody's watched it. And I just wanted to see the viewing figures, zero. But they said, their argument was that if they gave me this information, it could artistically compromise the people making the shows. Whatever that means.
Yeah.
It means you'd wave it in their face going,
look,
your show is
watched it!
That's another thing that annoys me about the BBC. I'm sounding very anti-BBC here, and I'm not sure that I am, but I think there's been an awful lot of flag-waving over the last couple of weeks where lots of celebrities have been lining up to praise to the hilt everything that BBC does as an institution, and I think that that's not a very useful debate. The thing that really annoys me about the BBC is the whole point is that the programmes are owned by us, the licence fee, who've paid for their production. And yet the percentage of their back catalogue that's actually available on iPlayer at any time is tiny. Where's the justification for that? Why wouldn't it be possible for them?
Because everything's outsourced to these. Nothing is made by the BBC anymore. They pay the production company.
Yeah.
They pay the talent. They then make the show. The talent invariably own the production company. The whole thing's a fucking sham, in my opinion. And that's one thing with the BBC that really get, even on the radio now, everything, this has been a so-and-so production for the BBC. You know, it's like, what? Yeah. I'm just listening to some random show on Radio 5, completely outsourced. The presenter invariably owns the production company. There's a lot of money being siphoned off there.
Yeah.
And those are all the people who've been on Twitter going, save the BBC.
Yeah. So if the BBC are spending this money, this public money, on these programmes, they should remain a public resource. If it became, because it could potentially be the most fantastic archive of entertainment and television and news and everything that could be made permanently available, then it would become a proper resource that nobody could begin to compete with. But they haven't turned it into that. And I can maybe understand the argument that stuff that was produced before iPlayer existed, yeah, the contracts were in place and it wasn't possible. But anything that's been made in the last 5 years should be available forever to watch when you want it, if you're a licence fee payer.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm just floating this out there. Say Bad Education, for example. Is that, when you, if you want to buy the DVD, are you buying that from the BBC or are you buying that from the production company who made it?
Well, it's interesting because people like Stuart Lee and Richard Herring have always said they had to buy the programmes off the BBC to sell them on DVD. Because the reason that the BBC would say that you can't sell these on DVD, that they're not going to sell them on DVD, sorry, is they said it's too expensive to produce and no, they wouldn't have enough people buying it. So then you get people like Richard Herring and Stuart Lee who put some money together, pay whatever it was, 10 grand, and then release it through Go Faster Stripe. And then they obviously make the money from it and not the BBC. So I don't know, really. I don't know how it works. I mean, I'm just sort of giving one example. I guess it's different for, like, say, whoever's actually made the programme. Well, whether it was in-house or sort of whoever's show, you know, if Steve Coogan wanted to release, you know, something obscure from his past, Coogan's Run, for example, would that be Baby Care who owned that, his company, or would that be BBC? I guess it would just depend on
the situation. It's a can of worms, dude, a can of worms.
Yes, let's all complain about the BBC, but go back to watching The Bake Off.
Complain about them, but also I do sort of, I know what Phil's saying, because I do support them as well. I want the BBC to exist. I think it's a good thing. It just maybe is in a bit of a rut, possibly.
It's hugely politicised as well, so they're between a rock and a hard place in terms of what they're wanting to achieve, particularly with a Tory government that wants to tear them to pieces. But my question is that necessarily the worst thing in the world?
Or bloody Thatcher.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Thatcher.
Topical, Steve.
Oh. Workers.
Yeah.
You can get a Mock of the Week with that.
Yeah. It would do. I'd probably be funny than half of them on there. To kick off our new releases, we're going to review American Ultra, which has been seen by myself and Phil. It's stars Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart. Jesse Eisenberg's character is a sleeper agent who gets activated. For me, it was just kind of a bit instantly forgettable, and it didn't work for me. It didn't kind of know what kind of film it wanted to be, whether it wanted to be a comedy or play it a bit more seriously, and you ended up with some kind of strange version of the two, and it just didn't quite. Yeah, it can't, you know, you didn't know if it was.
Yeah, I know what you're trying to say. I mean, it's Brooker wrote the review on our website. I haven't seen American Ultra, but as soon as he compared it to comedy dramas like, and I'm quoting, Burn After Reading and The Men Who Stare at Goats, I think that gives you a very good impression of what kind of comedy it is. Is that harsh?
Very
you disagree,
harsh. I would completely disagree. I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. I think there was... It twisted my expectations a bit. It was definitely marketed as a stoner comedy. And the last time I was on Fail Critics was reviewing Ted 2, when I spoke at length about how much I can't stand the genre of stoner comedy because there is nothing funny about people getting stoned. That is not funny in and of itself, but it's not that at all. And the character, I was expecting really 2D characterization of Jesse Eisenberg as just this guy, just this waster who wants to get stoned, and his deadbeat girlfriend in Kristen Stewart. And it looked from the pre-work that that's what it was going to be, just lazy stoner, just stereotypes. And they didn't play with that at all. They moved on from that really quickly. And what you got in the two lead characters was two really adorable people who genuinely were really into each other. And you felt as though you were invested in the relationship between the two of them. What was going on in the background, the action element and the the set pieces. They were proficient and they were fine, but it was lifted better by the relationship between Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart, who you forget, or at least I forgot, taking the Twilight films out of the equation, she's actually got quite good screen presence. And there's something about her that I found really quite captivating in this film. And I was really pleased with the way that her character was given the position that she was.
She's a funny actress, isn't she, Kristen Stewart?
Not initially, wasn't.
But you know, she's been in these Twilight films and got this reputation as not being a very good actress, or, well, you know, she does have a legion of fans who defend her simply for being in Twilight. You know, as soon as we mention her on Twitter from the Vale Critics account, oh, we've just reviewed, you know, whatever this film, American Ultra, for example, or we did Camp X-Ray, I think was the one we posted before that. And she was in Camp, and we mentioned, just put a name in, Kristen Stewart, starring Kristen Stewart. Loads of retweets, loads of favourites from all these obsessed sycophants who, I don't know what their purpose is in life, but it seems to be solely to post, share, and try and profess their love for this actress who just happened to be in Twilight. And I think that kind of overwhelms her reputation slightly.
Yes.
Because you see her in, I saw her in On the Road. I thought she was really good in On the Road. I've, you know, even back in 2009 in Adventureland with Jesse Eisenberg as well.
Yep.
I thought she was quite good in that too. I mean, you could even go even further back than that and say Panic Room, where she is a bit younger and a bit more inexperienced, but, and she's obviously upstaged slightly by Jodie Foster. But even in that, you sort of see flashes that, yeah, she probably is actually underneath somewhere going to be a good actress. I'm sure she doesn't regret Twilight because she'll never have to work again if she doesn't want to.
I wouldn't have said no if anybody had offered me that role. I mean, I was down to the shortlist, but I just didn't make the cut in the end.
I think the film would have been better. It's not a stoner comedy. It's not. Well, the main character is a stoner, but it's not, the jokes aren't based around him getting high. And I kind of agree with Phil that the two main characters, they're, you know, they are good. You do root for them. They are likable. I just think they're in a not very good film that needed to make its mind up whether it wanted to be a comedy or play it a bit more straight laced. I mean, I think people have seen from the trailer, there's like the over the top or action scene, you know, where he shoots a frying pan, which kills the bad guy. You know, the bullet deflects. So they could have done more with that, but still played it as a more kind of serious film than what they did. Some of the bad guys were just a bit stupid and irritating.
Was that John Leguizamo? Was he?
Yeah, he was. His character was just irritating as hell. Topher Grace.
Yeah, that was a bit disposable. I'll agree there. But you must, Steve, you must have enjoyed the Walton Goggins character. The laugher, depending on how northern you are.
No.
No, really? Okay.
I just thought that was stupid. It was just, but they could have possibly explored that side of things. I just think it needed to make its mind up what kind of film it wanted to be, and it would have been a better film for it.
Well, I think I'd watch Walton Goggins do just about anything. And just saying his name's always a fun thing to do as well. Mr. and Mrs. Goggins' boy.
Just going back to Brooker's review as well, just to mention, he also was very keen on Walt Goggins. He said makes a brilliantly twisted and nasty turn as the CIA's best in brackets worst exterminator. So you're not on your own, Phil. It seems he was quite popular, even if
good.
He disagrees.
There was also a showdown at the end of the film, which takes place in a hardware store, which I thought was really well done, especially compared to the turgid piece of shit that was done in the same way at the end of The Equalizer earlier this year, last year, whenever that was.
Hmm.
God, that was terrible. But I found that the bit in the hardware store, it was really fun. I liked it.
So that's what I mean. The action scenes like that were quite good. They were innovative, but they perhaps could have thrown a few more in or made them last a bit longer as well. They just didn't seem to be as many as what I was expecting for a film like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes, that's American Ultra. On to the final film we're reviewing, which everyone bar me has seen, which is Transporter 4 probably got some tagline, refueled or reloaded, re-something.
Transporter.
Transporter, really?
Transporter.
They missed the trick.
Yeah. That's the trend with these films, with these Luc Besson-produced films. Stick a number in there somewhere. Like Taken with a 3 as instead of an E. I think they should have gone for Transporter.
Taken 2, The Cleaners, or Taken 4, A Ride.
Oh, yeah, that would be... That would be a good description of what happens with those films. But yeah, Transporter. That's not going to catch on, is it? Transporter Refueled, to give it its proper title. He's back. The Transporter is back. I say he's back. What isn't back is Jason Statham, who's been playing Frank Martin, the getaway driver, for 3 films. Successfully, to some degree. The first was brilliant. I really enjoyed the first Transporter film. But yeah, so the guy's back, he's caught up in another thing, his dad's there, his dad's played by Ray Stevenson, there's some prostitutes trying to get away from their Russian ganglord pimp guy, and yeah, blah, blah, blah. It's just a typical sort of Luc Besson Euro thriller story. It's not particularly exciting. In fact, I would go so far as to say The Transporter Refueled is garbage. I really just came out of that screening and thought, what an utter waste of time that was. It was terrible. I didn't enjoy any of it.
I love the Transporter films. I really do. And if you go back to
before we talk a bit more about Transporter Refueled, let's talk a little bit about the original Transporter films.
You've got the first one, obviously you've got Luc Besson, but it's directed by Louis Leterrier, who... He went on and did some half-decent stuff. He did Hulk, Clash of the Titans. He's doing the new Sacha Baron Cohen film about football hooliganism, which I really can't... I think it's called Grimsby. but the whole concept sounds brilliant. But he's doing proper work. And he did number 2. Number 3, which always makes me laugh because the guy's name's... Isn't his surname Megaton?
He's the guy who also... is determined to ruin the Transporter films as well. Taken films, yeah.
But there's a formula there. Obviously, you've got the Stath, who is so charismatic, so charming, and you kind of... There's always some peril involved. In this, you know, with the new one, you never really felt anyone was in any danger at any point. But the most important thing for me is that the female... members of the cast, who in 1, 2, and 3, but very much in 2, I can't remember her name, Amber Valletta, I think it is. She's really striking, a really tall blonde woman. She's got the smoky coal black eyes, the stockings with the guns in them. She looks menacing. And all of the female characters in the first 3 are really strong, memorable. And there's just something about them. They're really, you can't take your eyes off them. And in this one, it looks like the lingerie models from a Lidl catalogue. You've seen it. Can you remember any of them?
Well, no.
Can you differentiate between the 4?
Well, that was the thing that they did. They deliberately, for some plot point that was completely unclear, they deliberately made them interchangeable because they were wearing all the same wigs and the same outfit, which was just confusing because there was no justifiable reason for it.
The only distinguishing feature was they were of different ethnicities.
Yeah, so if you got within half a mile of them, you could tell them apart very easily.
Yeah.
But no, I can't remember any detail of any of the 4.
But can you remember the ones in the preview? Do you remember the really tall blonde with the guns from number 2?
Is guns the infamous there?
I genuinely can remember very little about 2 or 3.
Okay, I guess if you're not into them, then you know you wouldn't remember them. But this is a weird thing because none of them have got great. If you look on your IMDb or your Rotten Tomatoes. None of the first 3 were particularly well received, which I find a bit strange. But the kicker is, over here, they're all 15s. In the States, these are all PGs.
PGs?
Yeah, all PG-13, all of them. And that really threw me. I was like, really? Fuck. I remember them being adult kind of thrillers, but they're not.
Were they edited down to PG-13s?
I don't think so, no. Because usually over here, you're 15, we'll will get a PG-13 in the States.
Yeah.
And that, because I've been on record multiple times of saying, I fucking hate PG-13 films aimed at adults, they're shit. And then I realised I love The Transporter 1, 2 and to a degree 3 as well.
Hmm.
Well, okay, well, so you love the previous Transporter films, and this one is a 15, Transporter Refueled, it is still a 15, so there's still some...
It's a PG in the States.
But PG in the States. But there's, you know, there's some violent kills in it, and he beats up a few people in quite graphic ways, I guess. But did you like Transporter Refueled at all? Was there anything about it that you sort of felt made it fit with the series and you were pleased to see back?
The thing is,
not.
Ray Stevenson was probably the only redeeming feature in the whole film. Mm. And I have a thing with British actors. If you haven't been in The Bill or Casualty, I'm not going to give you the time of day. And he's been in both.
Yeah, you need to prove you've put the legwork in.
Exactly. Whereas, how do you pronounce his name, the lead guy? Ed Screen? Screwin? Anyone?
Screen, probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
Apparently he was in Game of Thrones. Well, I've seen every episode. I don't remember the fucker.
Yeah, he didn't come back after season 4 or 5. He was the... Oh, God. He got replaced with... I can't remember any character names from Game of Thrones because none of them are actual names.
The problem with Game of Thrones is just too many names.
Dragon Girl's boyfriend.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's right. He had like 2 episodes in the season before he was established playing the same character. And to be honest, he was better in that role than the guy that took over from him, I think. I thought he was terribly suited to Frank Martin, though. He just didn't have that look about him at all.
I didn't think he was very well cast.
He tried to do an impression of Jason Statham. He tried to do the voice. He tried to do the mannerisms. They even did the little... If you watch the early Transporter films, and it almost harks back to old Bruce Lee films, the fight scenes always have a cutaway where he gives a cheeky look to the camera, which is, you know, or a dirty look. And they tried to include that, and it just was like cringe. It was awful.
So is it a sequel or a prequel?
No, it's a reboot. He's playing Frank. He's playing the exact same character as the Staith, and he ain't the Staith.
Is it a reboot, though?
Well, he's playing the same character name. And if you look at the timelines, it's the same timeline, so it makes no sense.
Well, it's deliberately vague on that point, isn't it? Because there's the Transporter TV series as well. Is that all part of the same story? I've never seen
that
any of that at
absolute
all.
Absolute shit.
I mean, it ran for 2 seasons, didn't it?
I watched 4, 5, and I was just like, I just can't do it.
I mean, it should really, in theory, be a premise that works repeatedly because he's just a getaway driver, isn't he? So we could get into all kinds of plots and stories, but I guess what they tried to do was link the first 3 films together. So there was a theme that ran through it, wasn't there? With he'd wronged the wrong person.
Yeah, but you had that, you know, they were an utter romp and they were a proper laugh, but there was always that slither of believability that ran through them. Just you might have been tiny, but it was there. Whereas this is fully into Crank territory, where it's completely ridiculous. I think it's the first one where he finds out the package is a girl and she gets out the car and he's panicking because he's worried about being caught with this girl. So there's always that kind of sense of peril. In the opening to this one, they shoot all those African guys on their steps, change the prostitutes over and get them working while the bodies are still lying there. It was just so, you know, it's so ridiculous and so stupid. And it pretty much goes like that for the whole film. And I just, apart from the soundtrack, I hated everything about it. It was utter, utter rubbish.
Yeah, I mean, the only redeeming feature I can think of is at least they haven't given it to that Olivier Megaton. At least he hasn't come in with his quick-cut action scenes where you can't see anything.
I think he would have done better than... Because that guy, Brick Mansions, is one of the worst films I've ever seen. Have you seen it, Owen?
No.
Steve,
no, I avoided it.
When he loses the quiz, Make him watch Brick Games.
don't do that. I mean, last time he gave me a, he thought it would be a good film to watch.
Yeah, I'm giving Rick up Scott. With that. I didn't like it. Yeah. So.
Brick Mansions, buddy, you're going to look. Because if you look, you know, it's just awful. You know, it's like people hanging off missiles, awful.
But this guy, anyway, let's give him a name. Camille Delmer. Is that his name? Camille Delmer, sorry. He has got some involvement with the Transporter franchise anyway. I think he was involved He made the tea? Yeah, it's got down he was an editor, but I suppose he could have made the tea at the same time. Could have made himself tea and not offered it around. But he was involved in Taken 2. So, you know, swings and roundabouts. Some are good, some perhaps not so good.
So,
last thing on this. Do you remember when the woman got, maybe I'm getting confused. A woman got shot, okay? The dad got a stick covered in cobwebs and some sugar.
Yeah, that's right,
stuffed it in the wound. Was she then not 10 minutes later swimming up underneath the boat?
Yeah, she was at death's door and then was suddenly miraculously better because cobwebs.
Cobwebs.
Yeah.
Magic.
Magic cobwebs.
And sugar.
And sugar.
Yeah.
Just...
It's an old army trick.
I know, but I mean, when you...
Have you ever been in the army, Phil? Paul, have you ever been in the army?
No, Steve. Is that
well? There you go. Then.
Don't know.
Okay, you just assume that I've never been in the army.
Yeah.
I tell you what, Steve. When the Somerset hoodies come and shoot you, you come and see me because I'll find some cobwebs and some sugar.
I'll be dead. I'll be shot.
Are we done with this piece of garbage?
Yeah, I think we might be. Let's go on to some recommendations for the week ahead. I'm going to go with Saturday night on Film 4, 10 past 11, sorry, and Seven Psychopaths from 2012. Also on Channel 4 that night, at the same time actually, is Chronicle. So you can see what Matey, who made a really bad Fantastic Four film, can do when he's on form.
Yeah, Chronicle's great. I hate found footage films. I just hate them. I really enjoyed Chronicle.
I think they get a bad rap.
Many of them.
That's part of the problem because they're so cheap to make comparatively.
I think probably, and I'm making this statistic up off the top of my head, one in every three horror films made now are found footage.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Is that a fact?
Yeah. It's a fact. I can't see any evidence to not suggest that would be true.
That seems low, if anything, to me.
Yeah.
But like I say, it's because it's cheap and they can make them without having to fork out for very, you know, any decent equipment, and it makes script writing a bit easier.
But my favourite experience in a film a couple of months ago, this is the moment of relief that I felt in a film, in Wreck 3... They start off as found footage, and then after the first 5 minutes, they finally drop the fucking format and make it not found footage. And just my heart went, oh, thank God. Thank God. I don't want to watch someone's shaky video phone.
It worked really well in Wreck as well. Did you enjoy Wreck Genesis?
The third
one. Is that the one on the boat?
That's 4, I think.
Did I enjoy it? I liked bits of it. It got carried away with itself a bit as well, though.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I like the third one, but I think I'm probably the only person who prefers it to the first. There doesn't seem to be many people on my side.
Anyway, Owen, tell us what you're going to watch this week.
Yes. Right, okay. It is a horror film, but it's not found footage. It might even be a PG horror film. But it's on the Horror Channel, which, if you've got Sky, is Channel 319, or it's also on Freeview now. It's been on Freeview for a little while. The Horror Channel on Saturday, right, 20 to 7 in the evening, Mask of the Red Death, the 1964 Roger Corman film with Vincent Price. That is the film that I watched and realised that, okay, I really like Roger Corman. And Vincent Price. And then last year I went on that binge of watching loads of Vincent Price films. It's because of Mask of the Red Death. It is brilliant. Visually brilliant. Vincent Price is brilliant. Story is iffy, of course, as it would be. But nevertheless,
who cares about story?
Who cares? Exactly. I mean, it's based on an Edgar Allan Poe short story. So, I mean,
who said this before? I mean, my late dad, his favourite actor was Vincent Price, and he used to go on and on and on about The Pit and the Pendulum all the time.
Pit and the Pendulum, yeah. Also Roger Corman, yeah. Brilliant. But Mask of the Red Death, it's 20 to 7 on Saturday on the Horror Channel.
Okay. Phil.
Okay. Coming out on Blu-ray, I don't know if it's this week or next week, is a special edition 40th anniversary special edition of Dog Day Afternoon, which is a phenomenal film. And that it's 40 years old, I find absolutely petrifying. that it could possibly be that long ago. It's bundled together with some special stuff. There's a commentary from Sidney Lumet, which I think has been released before, and there's also another disc with a documentary about, I'm going to get this, better pronounce his name wrong, John Cazale or Cazale.
Oh, yeah. Cazale,
that's probably it, isn't it? Who had a pretty phenomenal career before he died of cancer in 1978, only ever starred in 5 films, all of which were nominated for Best Picture. That's a career.
That's the way to do it.
Yeah. That's why I'm hanging on before I make my big screen debut. I want to make sure that the run I get, that they're all gold.
You want to work with Francis Ford Coppola, Sidney Lumet. That's the way to do it.
Yeah. So that looks like an interesting proposition, and which is I'm famous amongst my friends for really not being bothered at looking backwards when it comes to film, because there's just too much to see that's being made now. It's very rare that I'll watch a film from before I was born. One of the very few exceptions is Dog Day Afternoon, which I absolutely adore. And so, yeah, happy birthday, Dog Day Afternoon.
Okay, and Paul, finally.
Well, we need to take a moment and bow our heads as we say goodbye to Pete, Ruxin, Taco, Kevin, Andre and Jenny as the league. Tomorrow, it enters its final season. Since Owen and I discovered that we were Eskimo brothers, we've loved this show. and I just think it's probably the funniest TV show of the last 5-6 years. I love everything about it. I love all the characters. Hanging out with these guys has just been an absolute privilege. And I can't wait for the new, albeit final series. So, yeah, Netflix have got season 6 at the moment. In fact, all the seasons. So you've got 24 hours to catch up. And, really looking forward to it. And if you haven't seen it, well, then you're a fucking idiot.
Is it actually being shown on TV in the UK? Or
no, you'll have to download it.
Yeah.
Has any of it been shown in the UK?
I
think it's on Netflix.
Yeah, the first 6 are seasons, but the final season starts tomorrow in the US, so you'll have to wait, 8 months or whatever for it to come here, which is ridiculous. So
for absolutely no good reason.
Have you seen it, Sharman?
I find that people fall in one of two camps. They either prefer the league or they prefer It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and I'm very much a sunny man.
I like both.
But my preference is definitely with Sonny. I think it's a better show. But I do enjoy the league. I think I'm up to about halfway through season 5 and I kind of trailed off a little bit, so I ought to get caught up.
I'll check and see if we're Eskimo brothers.
Anyway, that's it for this week's Failed Critics podcast. Thank you all for joining us on this journey through film and nonsense. Phil, thanks for joining us as well. Do you want to tell our wonderful listeners where they might be able to find the Wiki Shuffle?
Well, if you
and what the Wiki Shuffle is.
We have our other podcast episodes go live every Tuesday at midnight. And we are a comedy podcast, that's official, where we press the random article button on Wikipedia and we talk about whatever we find out there, and hilarity ensues.
Yeah, the Mexican drug cartel one had me creasing up.
There's a bombing in Pakistan in this week's episode.
Sorry,
a bombing.
Oh, otherwise I was interested.
Yeah, but it, generally it's lighter fare. But yeah, it's give us a look. We're on the usual places where you find podcasts. I don't need to explain to people listening to this what a podcast is, which I do find myself doing about 20 times a week at the moment. It's kind of like a radio show, but not on the radio. No, it's not going in, is it, Grandma?
Yeah, but even your grandma's probably heard of cereal.
So yeah.
You know, cereal, it's like that, but funny.
Just tell them it's got bumming and it's on the internet.
Yeah.
They'd have found it by then if that was the case. Anyway, yeah, so that's Wiki Shuffle. Thank you very much, Phil, for coming over and spending time with us. I'm away next week, so Owen, you're in charge of everything. What's happening?
Well, Phil is coming back next week. He's on 2 weeks in a row. And then we've also got Jack from Wiki Shuffle. I like Jack, but you know, it's a shame we couldn't get Chris instead. But Jack's okay.
So you've got the two from Wiki Shuffle that I can remember the names of.
It was that genuine? You can't be serious.
No, I couldn't remember his name, the other one.
It's a very difficult name to remember.
It's, yeah, one syllable.
Doesn't matter how many syllables it is. It could be Dave. I could still forget it.
Yeah. But Chris isn't joining us. So far as I know, I mean, he might, in the sort of intervening 7 days, decide to join us.
He's been invited, but I think he's washing his hair.
Is he? Yeah. So we'll have Phil. Jack will be in your seat, Steve. He'll be hosting that week. Because the last time I hosted, it was so long. The podcast was so long and unwieldy. I had to split it into two episodes and release them separately.
Tough shoes to fill, Jackie boy.
And we've also got Brooker. Brooker's going to join us as well next week. So it should be good fun, I hope.
The Failed Critics podcast is presented by Steve Norman and Owen Hughes. Created by James Diamond, with original music provided by Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com, remixed by James Yule of JamesYule.com. You can find us at FailedCritics.com, on Twitter at FailedCritics, and Facebook at Facebook.com/FailedCritics. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.